This is Valley Talk on 1580 KGAL. I'm Josh Meredith, and my guest this morning is Dr. Bob Zybak. Dr. Bob Zybak, or Bob, is a longtime program manager of Oregon Websites and Watersheds online at orww.org. He is not, however, sounds like kind of like British humor. Here's all these things that he does. He's not, however, here for that reason. He is here talking about global climate change or global warming. And as we've established in the first half hour of this program, you don't really buy into it. You don't buy into it. I'm not. You don't believe it.
I believe that we have climate change, and I believe we're going through a period of warming at this point in time. But I think it's well within the natural flow of climate change over the eons. So I'm not certain that there's any a degree of emergency, whether this current warming is caused by people or not. I don't think there's quite the consensus that many scientists would have us believe. That sounds somewhat adversarial, but I would say it's more skeptical, and I think that skepticism is an important scientific attribute.
Another well-known global warming skeptic in Oregon happens to live not too far from here. Well, I don't know where he lives, but his job is to be the Oregon State climatologist, so I guess he goes to work in Corvallis.
You're talking about George Taylor.
Indeed.
Yep.
He also doesn't really seem to believe in it, and he's gotten some heat in the press because of that, and some heat from the governor of the state, Kulongoski. What is the deal with just right in this little area? There's a couple of guys who don't buy into what most scientists do.
Well, it's not just a couple of guys. It's a lot of scientists worldwide, and we know of each other and in lots of different fields that are skeptical about much of the drama that's going on with the media issues. To have George Taylor was on my committee. He was one of the best scientists that I've ever worked with, one of my most important committee members. I met him after I delivered a paper on global warming to an international convention on the issue. The paper I delivered was peer-reviewed. It was published by EPA before I ever met George, and it was clearly skeptical of the quality of the models that were being used to predict climate change at that time, and I think that those criticisms are valid. And there was a zero follow-up by the federal government other than publishing my paper, but certainly no follow-up on any of the strategies that I presented at that time, or really any of the conclusions I presented at that time that they printed up.
So why should we not conclude that you've published the idea and everybody thought you were wrong?
Because everybody doesn't even have an idea what my thoughts are. Skeptics in science are routinely marginalized by a variety of methods. Typically, they're not taken out in the statewide paper and savaged on the front page as happened to George or made the butt of political cartoons. But there are many methods in which people that do not buy into the prevailing wisdom or the status quo are marginalized. So when I gave proposals on mitigating strategies on addressing global warming to this international group of scientists that peer-reviewed my work, that didn't mean that I was buying into a safe and secure future. It meant that all my funding ended. And I'm not doing sour grapes. It's just a method in which scientific consensus is reached. One method is to stop funding so-called adversarial positions.
So when they say the debate is over, you would take certain umbrage at that?
Well, if the debate's over, it's not science. Science, you're always supposed to question the information you're given and the conclusions you're given and to examine the methods and the assumptions that are stated. And so science is an unending process. We can all agree that that's a fact. The world is round and a year lasts 365 days and we revolve around the sun, but those aren't points of scientific debate anymore. Global warming is.
Whether or not global warming is a legitimate topic, or I guess it's a legitimate topic, but if it is happening and it's man-made and it is bad, if we make all these assumptions, or if it isn't, is there still not a good reason to go through with some of the prescriptions that a person like Al Gore would suggest we do, such as cutting down on the burning of fossil fuels, and the whole, you know.
I think there's lots and lots and lots of good reasons to manage our forests more efficiently, to manage our resources more efficiently, to be more equitable in the distribution of resources worldwide, and we can go all the way from the international imbalance of trade, which is related to war, and terrorist acts at a certain level, to local employment in rural communities and the health of our forests and wildfire risk and risk of catastrophic fire to our wildlife populations. So I think that many of the proposals for mitigating strategies that I proposed in the early 90s remain valid to this time. And if Kulongoski and Gore and the Oregonian and those political and media position takers are serious about the need to sequester carbon to keep carbon dioxide out of the air.
Is that what you mentioned that earlier? I'm not sure if I know what the term sequester carbon means.
Well, our forests tie up on the land. Forests tie up most of our carbon. So if we're trying to remove carbon dioxide from the air, a plant takes in carbon dioxide and releases oxygen most of the day, most of the time. And so a tree will build up enormous amounts of carbon in living matter and the structure of those trees more than any other plant on the planet.
Because of its size.
Because of its size. So when you have trees growing, they are sucking carbon dioxide right out of the atmosphere.
Which is good.
If you believe that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is bad.
Well, we do believe that oxygen is good, and that's the byproduct.
Sure, but we don't need 100% oxygen to breathe. So if you get more water than you can drink, or more air than you can breathe, whether that's good or not depends on the perspective of you. It becomes a faith issue at some point. The survival of the species, of course, is what drives us, like every other species. So those types of attributes of plants and people and so on have developed over the millennia and millions of years.
So we've got the forests and they have all the carbon, and we're sequestering the carbon in the forests.
If most of the strategies we talked about 15 years ago talked about converting open land to forest land to mitigate or to address the problem of auto emissions in the United States. And it was found out that an area of five times the United States would have to be planted into trees, areas that did not have trees on them already, to sequester enough carbon to cover, I think, carbon emissions worldwide or something. So it was something that was impractical, impossible, almost silly in its mode. However, that still, in the state of Oregon and in the western United States and in Canada and Russia, the best option for addressing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere remains managing our forests more efficiently. And so I would propose that there are three...
Not to interrupt, but I would say that is not something that I hear in context with global warming too often. Usually it has to do with the burning of fossil fuels, of cars and of factories, and burning of coal and smoke and whatnot.
Right.
So I would only imagine that people listening to this program would say, those are unrelated. You're talking about global warming, and then you're talking about managing forests, and you're just trying to combine either, whether you realize it or not, you're combining unrelated topics.
You would think so, I guess, if you read the media or followed it very closely. There is as much carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere in Oregon from the B&B fire, a catastrophic fire, that is one over 100,000 acres in size, in a three-week period as the state produces from all other sources other than catastrophic wildfire in a two-year period. So if we'd put out that fire, that would be, a carbon footstep. It would be covering all of our action
for
2 years.
We can ride all the bicycles and drive all the electric cars we want.
You could not use enough electricity or drive enough SUVs to compensate for a fire of that magnitude. So just wildfires alone are ejecting enormous amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. As these forest burns, as these carbon sinks, which collect carbon, burn, that's where a very large amount of the carbon dioxide is coming from annually.
Well, doesn't everybody want forest fires to not take place?
You would hope so, but no, there is a large group of scientists, and there's some consensus among those scientists that say that catastrophic fires are part of the natural process, and we shouldn't intervene.
And you have to get back to your degree in catastrophic fire. How does your opinion of catastrophic fire differ from theirs?
Well, in many ways. For one, I don't think that there's a relationship between global climate change and catastrophic fire occurrence. Past events in the past don't correlate, so I think a big fear that our forests are going to burst into flames if the planet's temperature increases 0.8 degrees centigrade or some of the things I've read are even possible. There's no relation. So the one step to eliminate a wildfire would require a lot of proactive effort. Mostly it would be profitable to rural communities. It would reduce wildfire risk to wild animals and rural populations. Forest aesthetics would be improved, safety to campers and so on. It would be a prettier place. Some people would argue that those snags have a function, but that's never been demonstrated scientifically. That's just, again, speculation.
And snags, those are the
dead trees.
Dead trees that are still standing.
So we've got hundreds of thousands of acres of dead trees. So part one of the problem is we got wildfires that we're allowing to burn in wilderness areas or that are going out of control, that are injecting enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the air. Then once they've killed these trees, and we've got hundreds of thousands of acres of dead trees in western Oregon, a superabundance, an unprecedented large number of dead trees. These trees are rotting, and they are also daily putting more and more carbon dioxide in the air, and they'll continue to do so until they've rotted down, or more likely until they burn again, as the Tillamook burn did, the Tillamook fires did from the 1930s through 1951.
Is the general public aware? Until I talked to you about it before, I don't think I was aware of that particular issue when it comes to logging and whatnot, and that is snags, dead trees that have been burnt that are still standing. It's hard. You can't just go and cut those down.
It's illegal in federal lands. Most of Oregon is owned by the federal government. 80% of our forests are owned, our forest standing timber, or so the standing carbon of the state, are federally owned. So it becomes policy issues. So, no, it's been almost impossible. The Biscuit Fire burnt 500,000 acres. Maybe that might have been several years of carbon dioxide production for the state of Oregon. And now we have nearly 500,000 acres of standing snags still standing and rotting 5 years later. So now we have first the input of the carbon dioxide during the wildfire event, and second we have the rotting of the snags over time putting more carbon dioxide in the air.
So the way we're managing our forests right now results in the release of a lot of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere.
Particularly the last 15 and 20 years when we began passively managing our forests, the amounts of carbon dioxide from those forests has increased dramatically.
Now, which is counterintuitive because it has been environmentalist motivations that have led to our current forest management policies. Is that not true?
Well, a lot of people would believe that. I think generally that's true, that environmental movement has argued against logging, against fire suppression, and against global warming, and I think they haven't used science well enough to understand that those are really contradictory positions, that we could do, if we started suppressing wildfires and putting in prescribed fires to keep the fuel loads down, we would have to take aggressive action to prevent fires. We'd have to remove large amounts of fuels, which in this region is profitable to do. That's called selective logging. And so removing the fuels and starting prescribed fires and managing the smoke particulates, a lesser amount of smoke particulates, to alleviate the risk of wildfire and the severity of wildfire would be major things that we could do immediately that would have a profound effect on the amount of carbon dioxide released in the atmosphere in Oregon. Now, if we use those snags for biofuel as substitution for fossil fuels and for solid wood products such as desks, furniture, homes, things that don't rot as quickly, they're still going to decompose over time, but if we use those snags to produce those types of products, energy and solid wood products.
Is there good wood left in a burnt tree?
My crews cut down snags from the 1868 Yaquina fire in the 1980s that had a lot of sound wood. Cedar, of course, was still being mined, but there's a significant amount of wood that can be put into chips and was used for energy production even at that time. So for energy and certain types of wood, and it depends on how long the wood's been dead, how large the diameter of the wood is, but certainly a lot of sound wood can. The 1918 fire, that the Cedar Flats fire that led up to the Tillamook burn, trees were being salvaged in the early 1950s from that and for wood products.
Now, when you talk about prescribed fire, tell me what that is and how people wouldn't like that any more than they like field burning, and that's been a big
right.
topic lately.
Right.
You're talking about starting a fire on purpose.
Yes.
That sounds, once again, counterintuitive.
Well, if you don't set the fire on purpose, some people call them prescribed fires, and I think they're just been proven wrong by everything that's occurred since then. If they line out the fuels and they account for them and they wait for a lightning strike and then they allow it to burn wild, they're trying to accomplish that result. There's four parts to a fire. You got a topography, you got fuel, you got the weather, and you got the source of ignition. And so unless a person is setting that fire at the right time to make sure that smoke intrusions are minimalized, that fuel burnt is expedited, that certain conditions are met, you're going to have a wildfire. When you have a wildfire, you have whole communities smoked out for weeks or months on end. You cannot control where the smoke goes, where the fire goes. You end up burning up structures or adjacent forest lands. So, yeah, it is counterintuitive to produce smoke manage it in order to manage it and to manage those fuels, but it's a necessary step. It's the step that we've taken out of the process of forest management, a step that had gone on for 10,000 years and now is missing, that in my belief, and my studies support this, has led to these recent catastrophic fires.
So why do I feel very skeptical that Governor Kulongoski, who believes very much that we need to take action to combat global warming, why do I think he probably would not react positively to your suggestion that we fix the problem by logging Oregon's forests the way we used to?
Well, from what I've read in the papers, because I've never met the governor, I would say it's because he's a politician, that he wants the vote from the anti-logging people, because those are the urban voters in Portland and Eugene and the Willamette Valley, and he wants the vote from the green people, which are basically the same people that believe we need to control global warming and that type of thing.
Maybe it's even unfair to give you an opportunity to say, why wouldn't he do it? It's probably a better question that I ask, why wouldn't the environmentalists... they wouldn't. No, that group is not going to go for your plan. Somebody
no.
who says global warming is real, it's caused by all the SUVs and all the carbon we're burning.
Yeah.
They're not going to accept your prescription.
And the final point of that prescription is we need to plant good conifer trees wherever possible, because they store the most carbon in areas that we've harvested the snags. So stop wildfires, harvest snags ASAP, replaced with living trees. They're going to call upon some groups of scientists that say those things. There's a precautionary principle, and we can't take those actions because there might be negative results. But that's all speculation. I think there's been lots of opportunities to show scientifically, through experimentation, long-term studies, that these are unfounded concerns. So we do have people that are concerned on one level, but it really depends on how committed they are to global warming. If they're really committed to it and they really think that carbon dioxide is really a big problem, then they really should be for doing the things that I'm proposing, which is stopping wildfires, logging snags, and planting young trees. And they can even take a further step. When we tied up all this carbon into the fossil fuel reserves in the first place, it was during a period of time in which there was no frost on the whole planet. And I'm sure people could have lived under those conditions because we're very resourceful and adaptive. But those forests became the coal and gas reserves that we're using today. And so we can do the very same thing. If we're really worried about carbon, we can take it a step further and start logging living trees that have gone towards the end of their growing cycle, and put them into log banks, haul them to Antarctica, just float them down or sink them in the ocean so that they don't rot, and save them for generations 500 or 1,000 years from now, and keep soaking carbon dioxide up from the atmosphere. So there are definite steps we could take by managing our forests to address global warming. And yes, those steps run counter to the desires, I think, the same groups of voters that vote for new light bulbs also vote against logging. But I think that those are the options that we're missing because of maybe politics or media presentations.
Yeah, and all of this says nothing about the jobs it would create.
The jobs in Oregon would be tremendous. The amount of people it takes, and we've had those people in the past to do selective logging, to do tree planting, to do prescribed burns. We would have local people doing those jobs. Would be highly trained. They would know the area. They could do them a lot more efficiently than the casual labor crews we have, largely Mexican in the last 20 years, that do fire fighting activities at this time. So rather than having a lot of mobile, casual labor types of crews address these issues, they would be year-round employment, and the effects on the forest and the local economies would be profound.
We got to take a break. This is Valley Talk. We're talking with Dr. Bob Zybak on 1580 KGAL.